Okay, and our next speaker is Beth Riven, who will be speaking on women's health and the right to abortion in the U.S., International Human Rights Without Borders.
Hi, good morning. I'm going to switch gears and talk more about law and related policy. I guess first I'm supposed to introduce myself, is that correct? I'm Beth Riven, and I direct the Global Health and Justice Project at the University of Washington. It's a law school-based project, but has many arms and is multidisciplinary. I am primarily faculty at the School of Law, even though I don't have a law degree. And I have other appointments around the university. I also am vice president of an organization called Uplift International that implements health and human rights projects in the United States, as well as out of the country. We're working mostly in Southeast Asia. The talk today and my comments will focus on the U.S. Right to abortion, or lack thereof, and the basis for arguing that women have a right in the United States to abortion. I am also supposed to disclose any relationships that I have with companies and other entities that would bias any comments, and I don't have any to disclose. There's my disclosure statement. So I will first, in the next 13 minutes, talk about the conceptual border that we have in the United States, which is significant, and the definition of women's health, human rights law that supports the right to health even in the United States, and the international human rights law that supports abortion. Oh, that's forwards, that's backwards. In the United States, we define abortion as a part of reproductive health, of course, but we see it distinctly as a privacy issue. And that is because of the Supreme Court decision, Roe v. Wade, in 1973. Now, the problem with this decision and what has occurred subsequent to that decision is that abortion and access to abortion has been in a very tenuous position. The legal basis for this in the United States has been, whittled away. And you see around the United States, women's access to abortion being narrower and narrower. And there's really no right to reproductive health, as it were, in the United States, constitutionally or otherwise. So there's not a statute. The legislature, Congress, hasn't enacted a right to reproductive health and abortion, and we don't have it in our Constitution. We have it as interpreted as a privacy issue, but not as a health issue. Just to remind everyone, I'm sure you've seen this and heard this a thousand times during the conference, but health is very broadly defined by the World Health Organization, and it's complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. That highlights the understanding that health is clearly determined by underlying social indicators. There are underlying social determinants of health as well as reproductive health. Reproductive health is part of health. Women cannot be healthy without access to information and services in reproductive health. And that has been formally documented around the world for many years. So how does human rights promote women's reproductive health? Well, human rights is international law, and it articulates very well how women should have access, we'll talk about this in a few minutes, access to services and how to measure, and it's very well stated in law why and how women have these rights. But overall, human rights provide a framework to respect, protect, and fulfill the right to health. Now, what is the right to health for women or for any human being? Well, in 1948, the UN adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This international legal document was drafted, and it was a very long negotiating process to get the language accepted by the UN and the representative members who were on the committee to draft the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I'd like to remind you that there was a large presence of American lawyers, and Eleanor Roosevelt led the team for the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I like to make this clear, especially in the United States, because I think we have gone a little off track and we have forgotten that we actually promoted human rights over the years. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights really was a response to the atrocities of World War II. Bioethics and human rights, both movements really emerged from those atrocities. So our understanding of research ethics come from the blatant violations of research during the Nazi regime. And we have a code of ethics now to do research. And also at the same time, human rights came into being, the modern movement of human rights came into being, and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights really put a stamp of universal approval on those articulated rights for humans. And Article 25 in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights talks about health. And it says everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and of his family, including food, clothing, housing, medical care, and necessary social services. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights is not binding law. It's very aspirational. It's something to certainly move towards, but it is not binding law and is hard to enforce, therefore. In 1966, there were two international covenants that were adopted by the UN. And it took a long time from 1948 to 1966, and it is, if you look at history, you know that there was a Cold War there going on, and there was a very different understanding of health and other rights. The United States and many other countries were promoting civil and political rights first and foremost, and others were promoting economic, social, and cultural rights, and this international covenant was adopted in 1966. The United States signed it and has not ratified it, but signed it in 1992. And within economic, social, and cultural rights lies health. The ICESCR, as we call it, because it's hard to pronounce so long, Article 12.1 articulates the right of everyone to the enjoyment of the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health. This is very important language. The UN committee in 2000 wrote a comment, the UN Rights Comments, on many issues to explain certain aspects of adopted law, for instance. There was a clear understanding by the UN and those who drafted comment 14 on the highest attainable standard of health that countries and governments did not understand what the highest attainable standard of health was and how do you implement the highest attainable standard of health. By the way, the ICESCR is binding law. Countries and their representatives have to sign, and then the Senate or other entities have to ratify. Okay, a government has to sign and then take the next step of saying this is really going to be our law and we are going to adopt it as our law. Comment 14 says about the highest attainable standard of health, that is, health is a fundamental human right, indispensable for the exercise of other human rights. You cannot have civil and political rights. You cannot have the right to a fair trial and the right to assemble and the right to vote if you do not have the right to health. And that's what this comment 14 is saying. The right to health is not the right to be healthy. Comment 14 also advises us that the right to health extends not only to timely and appropriate health care, but also to the underlying determinants of health. In other words, governments have to do something about air pollution. They have to do something about access to information. If they are going to enforce and fulfill the right to health, especially if they've already signed and ratified. Comment 14 also talks about sexual and reproductive health and that it is inclusive. Oops. A further aspect of the right to health is participation. Populations need to participate in health-related decision-making. The comment also talks about how to measure the right to health, and this is really important. Availability, accessibility, acceptability, and quality. Availability means the availability of family planning services, the availability of clinics. Accessibility means geographic accessibility, information accessibility. Acceptability refers to cultural acceptability, local standards, and quality, of course, is about quality of care. I am going to have to run through this really quickly just as examples of the right to health and the right to abortion and reproductive services and information. Women have a convention, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. And I want to highlight the language, all forms of discrimination against women. CEDAW has many articles that articulate the right to reproductive health. Article 12 talks about access, including family planning access. Article 14 talks about rural women and the need to have information and counseling in family planning. The Convention on the Rights of the Child is also a very important document to understand. It is a binding legal document, just like CEDAW is, and it refers to children. Children also need access to information and services. Children are any human being below the age of 18. up until, excuse me, I mean up until the age of 18, once you're 18, you are considered an adult by international law. Again, this convention talks about mass media information, a diversity of information, the rights of the child to the enjoyment of the highest attainable standard of health, standards of living, that's a repeat, sorry. We need to, I propose, we need to really have a paradigm shift in the United States. We need to look at international human rights standards to support abortion rights in the United States. And I suggest that this is about rights to health. It isn't about the, you know, privacy. We need to focus on health, health of everyone, not only women. And just as an example of our tendency to sign and not ratify, the United States has ratified civil and political rights, the International Covenant, of course, has not ratified Economic, Social, and Cultural Convention, the Women's Convention, or the Convention on the Rights of the Child. There are many arguments. I unfortunately don't have time to underscore the some of the reasoning behind us not ratifying, but many of the arguments are that they are positive rights. We need to spend money to fulfill these rights. We do have a competent legal system, and we the government would be sued if they did ratify and didn't provide. And the counter argument, very clearly and very quickly, is to say that all of these rights about health are progressively realized. There's nothing in international law that says you have to immediately fulfill your obligations. You're just supposed to positively make progress towards realizing the goal. In civil and political rights, on the other hand, you have to immediately stop torture if you ratify, and I've got to stop. So just as a very, one more minute, there has been movement to locally adopt international law in the United States. We've seen that with CEDAW and the Kyoto Protocol. Cities have started doing something because our national, our federal government isn't moving fast enough for many local populations. I just want to show you a very nice quote from Justice Brandeis in 1932 on a case. He said, "It is one of the happy incidents of the federal system that a single courageous state may, if its citizens choose, serve as a laboratory and try novel social and economic experiments without the risk to the rest of the country." And indeed, that's what's going on in this country. We see San Francisco has adopted CEDAW in 1998, and many other cities around the country have done this. You too can do this. You too can start in your communities a whole campaign to adopt CEDAW. We in Seattle have adopted the right to health care. It was strategic language. We couldn't write the right to health in this ballot initiative. We can talk about the reasons for doing that. Tacoma also has adopted the right to health care in Washington State. We're actually a little experiment because no one else, to our knowledge, has done that yet. These are the two organizations I work with, and you can get in touch with me if you have any questions. And that's it. Thank you.
One question.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. And you're also considered an adult when you're 18, right?
No, if you're your first date.
Where is first date? Yeah. But when do you have the right to
That varies by state.
Some states, there is no major complaint.
Yeah.
And other states, it's 15. Okay. And other states, it's 16. It totally varies by state.
But do you have the right then to have an abortion
yes.
at
any
14
age,
or?
Any age in some
yeah.
states.
Any age in some states.
15 in other states.
Okay.
16, 18. It really depends.
It depends, yeah.
Yeah, and there's some states that have parental notification for minors.
Every
state's
yeah.
different.
Okay.
Different. Okay.
And for some states, once you become pregnant, you're emancipated, so you can make it.
Right.
Right.
But
you really depend on yourself.
Right. Right. But yeah, we are a federation, and so state law is much it's binding for local populations. Thanks.
Thank you. We will have a few minutes at the end of the participants' discussions for more questions. So if you have them, hold on to them. Our next speakers. Are Catherine, is it Luchak, and Nikki DeSalvo Amick, and they're going to be speaking on birth beyond the borders, vaginal births after cesareans, and just a couple of words about the speakers. Nikki is a South Carolina mother of two, the firstborn surgically and the secondborn at home. She is a grassroots organizer, consumer advocate, and writes about various holistic practices, including but not limited to birth. Nikki is a founder and director of a daughter chapter of the International Cesarean Awareness Network and is South Carolina's ambassador for the Coalition of Improving Maternity Services. Catherine currently has laryngitis, so she's going to try and struggle through her presentation. She's director of director of policy and research center, Southern Institute on Children and Families, adjunct faculty, University of South Carolina, Arnold School of Public Health, maternal and child health specialist, focusing on research and policies that promote the best outcomes for women and their families. And I think, are you going to start first, Nikki, or Catherine, you're going to give it a shot? Okay. Get this set up here.